This is Mark, the podcast producer again, and this is the second part of our episode to celebrate the arrival of Colossus at Bletchley Park 80 years ago this month. In this show, we look at the arrival of the machines and how they helped to break Lorentz. Now over to the show.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the January 2024 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Colossus in Context. 80 years ago, in January 1944, the first Colossus computer was delivered to Bletchley Park. This machine and the nine that followed it have acquired legendary status within the story of World War II codebreaking. The machines have also been described as the world's first large-scale electronic digital computers, direct precursors of the digital world in which we live today. But in 1944, the computer age still lay far in the future. These machines were built for a specific and vital purpose, to assist with the breaking of the wireless messages of Germany's senior commanders, enciphered using the Lorentz cipher machine, and known at BP as Tunny. What role did Colossus actually play in the breaking of Tunny? The Colossus machines were members of a wider family of machines, and the Numenery, the department in which they operated, was only one of several teams at Bletchley Park, all of whom were crucial to the successful breaking of the cipher. In this It Happened Here episode, Bletchley Park historians Dr. Thomas Cheatham and Dr. David Kenyon are here to place Colossus in context, and examine where exactly these machines fitted into the effort to break Tunny. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Now, we know with Enigma, it was constantly evolving during the war. Was a similar thing happening with Tunny?
Very much so. I mean, one of the reasons we get to Colossus in the end is because the way the Germans are using the Lorentz machine evolves as time goes on, and the problem gets increasingly difficult for Bletchley Park. One of the main areas where this applies is in terms of the key setting, the way the machine is configured for each message. And like we talked about with Enigma, you have part of the setting which is created and installed in the machine according to a prearranged plan, you know, from a code sheet or whatever.
Yeah.
In this case, the machine is unlocked by an officer who has a key to the internal workings of the machine. And then there's a part of the key which is set by the operator before he sends a message. And he has a choice in how he goes about that. How this works specifically, we've talked about these 12 wheels on the front of the machine. So, firstly, all the pins on the wheels have to be set. And in the early days, there are different cycles for how long these wheels stay the same. An officer would come in and unlock the machine. The first five wheels are changed every month. The second five wheels are changed every 3 months. So they stay the same for a hugely long time. Mm. And the motor wheels, as they're called in the middle, the ones that control how fast the second set move or yep. whether or not they move, they're changed every day. But your two big blocks of wheel, your two big five-unit blocks, stay the same for quite a long period. What that means from the Bletchley Park point of view is that if you break those wheels, if you work out where the pins are, you can reuse that information for a whole month, or in yeah. one case, for 3 months. And the process is also made easier by how the message key is transmitted. And this is the starting position of the wheels. They can be moved, like on Enigma, with the cover shut. You can still position the individual wheels to a certain starting setting. And again, like Enigma, the operator was able to choose those settings, which is a problem because you shouldn't really let the operators choose these things because they don't choose randomly enough.
But no.
We've been there before.
Yep.
In the case of Lorentz, in the early days, they have a very specific gadget that they use for this process because the operator has to send which positions he's used for all 12 wheels to the operator at the other end. so that the other guy at the other end can set his machine up to the same setting so he can understand the message. And the way they would do this was they had a metal frame with 12 columns on it and sort of little sliders that you could move up and down. And each column is 25 letters long. They don't use the letter J, so they use the other 25 letters of the alphabet. The starting position of each wheel is numerical because, you know, one wheel might have 61 positions on it, the other wheel might have 23 positions on it.
Yeah.
So you're going to have 12 numbers, two-digit numbers, between your 1 and 60-something. So what they do is they produce a paper sheet which has 25 of the possible numbers for each wheel. Some of the wheels have more than 25 positions, but they only use 25. They select a random 25 positions for that wheel and print them in a random order on the sheet.
Okay.
And so you've got 12 columns of apparently random numbers which relate to the possible positions of the wheels. And then you have these little metal sliders. And what the operator does is he gets his relevant sheet for the current period of the wheels, be it a month or whatever, puts that in his gadget. And then he chooses at random and slides the little sliders up and down to a supposedly random position. He then reads off the alphabetical characters, the 25 alphabetical characters on each column. So he ends up with a string of 12 letters. He breaks those letters down into pairs, into bigrams. And Tom and I were a bit confused about this the other day. We were discussing it because you go, why does he break them down into bigrams? Because what he actually does then is he sits at his teleprinter, and the way these systems work is you can either switch the Lorenz cipher machine on or off. And normally he'd have it switched off and he'd type en clair, as it's called, in plain language. He'd send a message, usually using Q code, similar to a wireless operator, normal wireless operator. He'd say, you know, hello, Vienna, are you there? And they'd type back, yes, we are here. We can hear you. The signal strength is good enough, et cetera, et cetera. And then he would say, right, he would type letters QEP, which was Q code for, I'm now going to send you the message key. And then he would send the 12 letters that he'd got from his gadget for the wheel settings. We were discussing why would these be separated into pairs, because you're just going to send them as 12 letters anyway. But actually what it was a garble check. What they would do, they type a pair and then a comma and a space, and they type another pair and then a comma and a space and type another pair. And it's much easier to read them and check them if they're separated into six pairs rather than if they're just a block of 12 letters. We think that's the only real reason they do this. Anyway, he sends the 12 letters to the guy at the other end. The guy at the other end gets his equivalent Spruchtafel, as it's called, his device with the paper sheet in it. He slides his sliders to the relevant 12 alphabetical letters, and he can then read off from the paper sheet inside what the actual wheel settings are.
Right, okay.
So he then sets all the wheels on his Lorenz machine, and what he would typically do was he would then type the 12 letters back in plain language to the first guy to say, this is what I thought you sent. And the guy at the other end would say, yes, that's correct, or no, it's not. And once they know they've both set their machines to the same wheel settings, which have been communicated, essentially encoded by this Spruchtafel, they'd say, right, we're ready to go. And then they would send a special Q code, which said, switch on the machine. And they'd both switch on their Lorenz machine. And then at that point, the guy would start typing the actual content of the message.
Okay.
And the machine at the other end would automatically decipher the content. So actually, neither the guy at the first end or the guy at the other end ever sees the ciphertext.
No.
Because it's encrypted automatically and then it's decrypted automatically. Yeah. That's quite a long explanation. What this meant for Bletchley Park is each time they intercept one of these messages, they have these 12-letter preambles. And actually, when the machine was used for cable traffic, landline traffic, they simply typed the letters. But because of all the interference that Tom was talking about, when they use it by wireless, they still send the letters in pairs, but they use German phonetic alphabet. So instead of Abel, Baker, Charlie, they have Anton, Caesar, Bruno. So at the beginning of each message, you get a 12-letter phonetic sequence.
Which is a lot easier to break, I imagine.
Well, what it does, it doesn't tell you the wheel positions, because that's been hidden by the Spruchtafel. What it does tell you, and this is critical, is it tells you when two messages have been sent using the same wheel settings, what's called a depth. And so long as the Germans are using this system, it's really easy to spot depths, because they have this same 12 characters. The other thing it allows you to do is spot what they call partial depths, where of the 12 settings, 11 of them are the same, but only one is different. And from a codebreaker's point of view, if you have 11 wheels all the same and one wheel different, it actually gives you quite a useful way of working out what the wheel settings actually are. because you can look at the five unit characters that those wheels would create and spot the difference between them, and that allows you to access the one wheel that's different on the two machines. You start to see what the pin combinations are. So it's a really useful thing. The problem is that in October 1942, just as these systems are getting widely operationally used, the Germans abandon this procedure.
Ah.
So they stop conveniently sending the 12 characters at the beginning of the messages. What they do instead is they issue the machine operators with a book of settings, each of which simply has a number. And so they just send QEP, which is here comes the setting, and then they just send a number. And the operator at the other end looks that number up in his book and uses those appropriate settings. So all of that information that you've had in the 12 characters has suddenly disappeared. You can still spot a depth, because if two messages have the same number, they're still obviously using the same setting. But all those occasions when you could spot the partial depths, where 10 or 11 of the wheels were the same but one of them was different, you can no longer do that. The other thing it's doing is, when the operators had to slide these little slides up and down on their Spruchtafel, being humans, they didn't use all the possibilities, and they used a relatively narrow pool of settings, just by human nature. And so you got a lot more depths occurring than you do with a set book that forces them to use these individual numbered settings. Yeah. So a whole lot of information that was previously in the preamble to the message and was really, really useful to Bletchley Park has suddenly disappeared. You're then like, how do we go about breaking the wheels, working out the pin settings on the wheels, if we don't have these key setting information? The other thing that the Germans do in 1942, a little bit earlier in August, which is equally annoying, is Tom talked about the fact that a lot of these messages are quite stereotyped, and it's the classic Bletchley Park thing. If you can crib it, if you can guess the content, you get in. But the Germans know this as well. So in August, they tell their operators to use what are called Wahlwörter, arbitrary words is what those in German. They actually call them Quatsch, which is a German name for rubbish. But they say, right, put between 10 and 60 characters at the beginning of the message, which are just random words, just garbage, and push your actual message content further down. So whereas previously you might have a message that had a really obvious opening phrase. I mean, they often used Spruchnummer. They would say message number 42, you know, from Berlin to so-and-so. And that's a really easy crib. If they put in characters of garbage before they do that, and it might be 10 letters or it might be 60 letters, you know, it makes it much harder to spot those cribs or to fit those cribs to the message. Interestingly, the German operator says, if you're going to use Wahlwörter, you can't use any of the words that you'd normally use in a message. You have to use genuinely random, completely irrelevant words.
Okay.
It says, don't use words like message in your... Yeah. It sounds bleedingly obvious, but they were clearly aware that their operators weren't necessarily the most imaginative people in the world. So they're doing these different things, and any one of these problems in and of itself is not shutting Bletchley out necessarily. It's just making the job harder. Mm. And every time the Germans introduce a new security measure, things get harder. They also introduce a thing called the limitations, which is where the wheels in the middle of the machine that decide whether or not the second set of wheels move isn't the only thing that decides whether the second set move or not. They also use the position of one of the first set of wheels, what they call the P5 limitation. They use the position of that wheel, whether that wheel is a dot or a cross, as well as the motor wheels, to decide whether the third set moves. And again, this is not an insurmountable problem, but it's an extra layer of complexity that the Germans are adding. And all the time, Bletchley is, it's like you're climbing a mountain, you think you've seen the summit, and you go over and you go, oh no, that was only just a ridge. There's another bit yet. And the story all the way up to the delivery of Colossus in January 44, and after that onwards, is a story of these sort of successive summits of it just getting harder and harder and harder. And the other thing, of course, they do in July 1944, which makes life really difficult, is instead of changing the pins on the wheels every month, they change the pins on the wheels every day. So a process that you were having to do once every 3 months for five wheels and once every month for five wheels, you're now having to do for 10 wheels every day. And you can imagine that's exponentially increased the number of wheel breaks that you have to achieve. And so the techniques that Tom was talking about that they apply in the early days, you can't really use anymore because the problem has just become larger and larger. Also, the Germans are sending more and more traffic. So there's just simply more and more messages that you're trying to attack. As we said at the outset, this isn't about a single problem being solved. It's about keeping up with an evolving problem.
This ever-evolving problem, how on earth did GCNCS respond to it? And how many people are working on this? You know, where are they working on this?
Well, luck plays a big part. As Tom has talked about, you have Jerry Morgan's research section working on all of these problems. And they have come up with solutions that Ralph Tester's people, the testery as they're called, are applying. And they're doing a lot of work with depths and a process called dragging and various other things. But simply because they've come up with one solution doesn't mean that the cryptologists at the heart of the thing, people like Tutte, they're still working away at the problem. You know, because they've got a method that works, they haven't stopped thinking about it. They're still trying to think of other methods. Tutte, in his memoir, he talked about the days of the indicator up to October 42, this idea that while they were getting these 12-letter indicators, life was, in hindsight, easier.
Yeah.
It was still an extraordinarily difficult task, but he looks on it as sort of a golden age, if you like.
Yeah.
He also referred to the winter of our discontent being the winter of 42-43, when they've lost the indicators and they're really struggling. But he, in the meanwhile, has been thinking about other solutions to the problem. And it's during this period that he comes up with what's called the statistical method, the solution that Colossus ultimately applies to wheel setting for Lorentz messages.
And is this what we know of as built at breaking Lorentz?
It kind of is, but it isn't, in the sense that, as is always, these things get simplified into the idea that in 1941, he and Tiltman sit down and he reconstructs the wheels of the machine. And ta-ra, Lorentz is broken, problem is over.
Yeah, that's the story we're told, that it happens once and then that's it.
And then Colossus is invented to mechanize this process and on you go. Actually, it's much more complicated than that, because simply identifying how the machine works is not breaking the cipher.
No.
Breaking the cipher is a whole separate process. And actually, we've already described how visualizing the machine is step one, breaking the wheels is another step, setting the wheels is another step. Both breaking the wheels and setting the wheels are attacked using all sorts of different methods. And if we look back at Enigma, the way you break Enigma is by the application of all sorts of different hints and tips that all contribute a little part to the process. And added together, they give you a path to finding a solution.
Yeah.
Exactly the same is happening here. And Tutte, while some of his discoveries, inventions are already in use, he's still thinking about other ones. He's still going, how can we improve this process? How can we move forward? And it's during that winter that he identifies what's called his statistical method. The short version is Baudot code that we've spoken about, this original five-unit code on which the whole system is based. The system that's being used in the Second World War is Baudot-Murray code. There's a second man called Murray who gets involved. One of his contributions is to look at the original code that Emil Baudot invented, and he noticed that if it's on paper tape, if it's holes in a paper tape, those tapes can be prone to tearing. So to make the tape more robust, it's better if the most frequently occurring letters in the alphabet have the fewest holes in the tape. So letters like E and S are represented by more dots than crosses, and rare letters like Q and Z are represented by lots of crosses or lots of holes, effectively. And what that means is natural language, either English or German or military German or anything else, you can analyze the frequency with which holes appear in the tape. Because if there's lots of E's at the edges of the tape in what's called the first impulse, the first position on the tape, for common letters, there won't be very many holes. And what he hypothesized was anything that's gibberish, anything that's ciphertext or random, because it's random, you'll end up with 50% of holes. Anything that is anywhere close to or a shadow of some sort of natural language will have fewer than 50% of holes. It might only be 51 or 52%. It might be a very small margin. And depending on how close you've got to the original text, that statistical bump will be smaller or bigger. There are a whole series of techniques applied after that discovery which exploit this statistical anomaly in Baudot code in different ways, but they all come back to this basic principle that letter frequencies in the underlying plain text are somehow represented in the frequency of the holes. And he develops that over the winter of 42 into 43. The problem is, in order for these statistics to show up, you have to count so many thousands of holes that it's not a technique that is any use to if you've just got people, no matter how many wrens or grumpy army corporals you put in a room with squared paper, they're not going to count enough holes for this to work.
Yeah.
It's a method that will need a mechanical solution. It's a kind of brute force attack in a way. It just involves lots and lots and lots of counting. And this is where the specific path to Colossus begins, because this is the point at which they say, as in a similar way to they did in 1940, 1939 with the bomb machines, they say, there is a part of this problem that we need to solve mechanically. And as we talked about this time last year with the founding of the Newmanry and Max Newman, he joins Bletchley Park in August of 42. In the autumn of 42, they're discussing all of these engineering problems, this idea of mechanizing the process or parts of the small parts of the process. And the machine section, as it's called, is created under Max Newman in order to start building devices that can use Tut's statistical attacks on the cipher. And that's where, as I say, the road that ultimately leads to Colossus kind of starts.
Tom, David's explained the setting up of the machine section. That's called machine for a reason. What machines have they got?
Well, they don't have any when they're set up. There are some decoding machines, known as British Tunny, which I mentioned before, but there aren't any key-finding machines. And the Newmanry is set up to work out how to produce key-finding machines. And it seems like it's not got that open a remit because they have a machine in mind, and it's the machine that we come to know as Heath Robinson. And so Newman's gone to Travis and said, I can get this machine built, and he's been tasked with carrying that out. Because what he's realised is, if you enact the statistical method that Bill Tut had come up with, if you get a machine which takes two tapes, one of which has the ciphertext and one of which has what they call a D-chi, so it's a keystream with the chi wheels stripped off it. You've worked out the chi wheels by hand methods already, so you remove that from the tape. And you also delta both tapes. You add successive characters together, which, as I mentioned before, knocks out the effect of the psi wheel half the time. Therefore, if you add the two tapes together half the time, you should be seeing something that's plain text. And if you can run those tapes alongside each other, add them together and count the number of dots, when you've compared them at the right position, the position that reflects the starting positions of the wheels for enciphering that particular message you're analyzing, you will spot an increase in the number of dots, and that will be your message setting. So they set to work designing this machine, and they go to the post office, the GPO research station at Dollis Hill in North London, where they know about teleprinters, telephone exchanges, and this sort of electromechanical technology. And it's one of their designers, Frank Morrell, who mostly designs Heath Robinson. But it's a team effort. This is the first time we see Tommy Flowers come on board in relation to Lorenz, and he's a up-and-coming engineer at the GPO. And he comes to the attention of Bletchley Park because he'd done some work to do with the bomb machines for breaking Enigma, and particularly the four-rotor Enigma problem, which they'd been working on through 1942. And his designs hadn't really been used in the end, but they spotted him as quite a talented individual.
There's a connection there, isn't there, already?
So they go to him to design the combining unit, which is what adds the two tapes together. And there's also a counter in there to count the number of dots produced, and that's designed by a man called Charles Wynne Williams, who's from the Telecommunications Research Establishment, a separate organisation, and they're the people who work on radar. They're the radar experts in Malvern. And he had expertise in designing counters, which were used quite heavily in research into fledgling nuclear technology. So also another very important figure. This is a real team effort. It's not one man designing this whole machine. They're at it from January to June 1943, and that's when Robinson is delivered and put to work. And it does work. This is the point about Robinson. If you look for the real breakthrough moment where you've mechanized the breaking of Lorenz, it's not when Colossus comes in, it's when Robinson comes in. It's not very fast. It reads the tapes at a maximum of about 2,000 characters a second, but they actually run it a lot of the time a lot slower than that because they have these problems with the tapes becoming desynchronized, stretching and the sprocket holes wearing away and the counting being unreliable as a result. So they have these technical issues, but Robinson does work. And on its own, it is, you know, the foundation of breaking Lorenz for about 6 months before Colossus comes in. And even after Colossus comes in, actually, they're using Robinson for various things. It can do things like crib dragging tasks because it can take two tapes, things that Colossus can't actually do. And they solve a lot of those technical issues later on with later Robinson models. They eventually build four of them. And they also build an advanced version, which is overseen by Tommy Flowers after he does Colossus. and that has four tape reels for performing really quite complex calculations. And they have two of those Super Robinsons that come in. So these are working alongside Colossus right through to the end of the war, and they're always useful. It's really important to stress that.
Now, we have mentioned some of these other people who had a role to play in this design, but the mythology of this story is that Tommy Flowers invents Colossus on his own, isn't it?
Yeah, even though it's from his own account, it doesn't seem to match up very well with the facts and the contemporaneous evidence we have at the end of the day. For example, there is a document produced by Max Newman very early on in the existence of the Newmanry, 1st of March 1943. And it's a progress report to Edward Travis about how things are coming on with Robinson. And this talks about how Flowers has an idea for a more ambitious machine, and Newman is all for the idea, if it works. The thing is, he can't put all his eggs in one basket and say, let's go for an advanced, untried design involving thousands of valves. We have to prioritise Robinson because it relies on existing proven technology. We know it will probably work. But if Flowers can go away and build a more advanced machine which is faster and also works, that would be great. So this does not fit with the narrative which we often hear, that Flowers conceives Colossus as a more advanced machine and then Bletchley rejects the idea. Mm. Newman is absolutely on board with the idea. He just thinks they have to do Robinson first.
For Commander Travis, from MHA Newman, 1st of March, 1943. Report on progress. 1. The plans for the mechanical setting of Tunney and Sturgeon are going ahead. The tests at Dollis Hill on speed of moving teleprinter tape came out favourably. They have been able to get the tape past a given point at the rate of 2,000 letters a second, without any signs of excessive strain. This would be enough to carry out the difference method of setting in a moderate time, if several machines and counters were available, though something faster would be required to keep current if the traffic were considerable. This machine will in any case be most valuable as a means of carrying out in a reasonable time experiments which cannot be tried at all at present, owing to the excessive labour involved. 2. Flowers, of the Post Office, has produced a suggestion for an entirely different machine, in which the message, and the wheels to be compared with it, would be set up on valves by means of relays. This would involve 5,000 or so valves, and about 2,500 relays. The heat the valves were to generate would be equal to that of 8 2-bar electric fires. Mechanical movement would be avoided altogether, and speeds of 5,000 to 10,000 a second would be possible. This is, of course, a much more ambitious scheme. I feel that this is basically the right sort of approach, and that it is very much to our advantage to try out these techniques, and, if possible, get a step ahead with them. At the same time, since there is a risk of hold-ups along these new paths, I emphasise that the simpler tape machine, which has also the advantage of easy adaptability to all sorts of purposes, should be gone on with also, at full speed. They are quite willing to follow up both lines at once, and that is what I recommended should be done. A pretty strong priority will be wanted to get that number of valves and relays in a finite time. Signed, MHA Newman.
The other factor here, of course, is that Flowers gets the support of his boss at Dollis Hill, Gordon Radley, and he gives him 50 staff to work on Colossus. So this is obviously not going on under the radar, under anyone's radar. Flowers has backing from Newman at Bletchley, he has backing from his bosses at Dollis Hill, and he's given all this staff and presumably all these funds to work with.
Is there a similarity in the breaking of Enigma and the breaking of Lorentz in the way that we still have these hand methods going on, but also some mechanical devices are brought in? I mean, with Enigma, it's the bomb, and with Lorentz, it's Heath Robinson to start with, and then later Colossus. Is that a good analogy?
It's absolutely comparable. It's kind of spooky how similar the two examples are.
Right.
We start off breaking by hand, you bring a machinery later on to increase the efficiency and the amount that can be broken, and sometimes to overcome technical issues. But the handwork never finishes.
No.
It never stops. And the process is never fully mechanized. There's always handwork to do before the tests go to the machinery, and there's always work to do after they come back. So for example, with Colossus, you're setting messages on that machine, but you're only quite a lot of the time setting the Chi wheels, and then the Psi wheels are set by hand, because that's quite a straightforward hand process once you know what you're doing. And they're always doing the wheel breaking by hand as well. So like 3/4 of the problem is not being done by Colossus.
I think both devices have had this mythology built up around them. With Enigma, it's you put the message in one end of the bomb machine and the plain German comes out. And with Lorentz, it's you put the Lorentz message in one end of Colossus and this German comes out and this typewriter. Neither of these are correct, are they?
Absolutely not. You're just working out part of the cipher key. The machine is telling you part of the cipher key, and then you have to do a lot more work afterwards to actually turn that into decrypted messages. But what's interesting to think about, I think, is whether the Numenery actually draws lessons from Enigma and the bomb, because that's all well established by that point.
Yeah.
There must have been some awareness when the Numenery is set up, obviously, that you can mechanize these sorts of problems. You have Gordon Welshman, by this point in the war, as Assistant Director of Mechanization, overseeing all of the bomb work, but also all of the Numenery work as well. So there's a very clear organizational basis for applying lessons from one project to the other. But on the other hand, I don't think they knew exactly where it was going with Lorentz. Because it's one thing to say that we can apply machines to code-breaking problems, and it's another to actually know how that's going to look like in practice. And I think there's probably an alternate history, if the Lorentz cipher had been a bit different, where the Numenery can't get the methods working well enough, and then it all gets wound up and fades into obscurity and we never hear about it. So I don't think the development of the Numenery is planned from the start. I don't think they knew exactly where it was going, but it certainly comes out of a general idea that key finding can be mechanized in some form, and they're put together to explore the possibilities and see where it takes them. And in the end, as we know, it takes them quite a long way.
I guess it's about time we mention Colossus, really, as this episode's about Colossus and we haven't really mentioned it. But we did say we wanted to put Colossus in context. So how does Colossus come into the picture?
Well, Colossus comes into the picture as a development of Robinson, I think it's fair to say. The task it's performing is identical to what Robinson does. A lot of the technology behind it is identical, even though the two machines are partially being developed in parallel. Tommy Flowers is involved with both projects, and it would be very surprising if he wasn't taking lessons from Robinson and applying them to Colossus. Even though Colossus is being developed alongside Robinson, if Robinson didn't work, again, you can imagine an alternate history where Colossus gets wound up because the technique isn't workable.
Mm.
And again, it never goes anywhere. We never hear about it. So the fact Colossus gets that backing and is carried through to completion is undoubtedly because Robinson works and because Colossus is not promising to do anything new. It's promising to do what Robinson does, but better and faster. That's really important to stress. Now, it's very clear that Colossus is a development of pre-existing ideas because there is a famous memo where Max Newman, again, he's writing to Edward Travis with a sort of progress report, and he types the line, Colossus arrives today. And this is on the 18th of January, 1944. And this is meant to be the pivotal moment. What's really interesting, if you look at this memo, Colossus arrives today is the final line. 90% of it is about things that aren't Colossus. It's all about how the work they're doing with Robinson. And all the terminology and all the theory behind what he's describing is all familiar to us from reading about Colossus, but it's all in existence before Colossus is even working. So again, this is a really strong indication that the foundational work, working out whether Tut's technique is viable and how you can mechanize tunnel breaking, is all pioneered on Robinson, and Colossus just does it better.
To Commander Trevis, from MHA Newman, 18th of January, 1944. Report on progress. 1. On the basis of about a month's experience of the P5 limitation, it can be said that there is no substantial increase in difficulty in the machine methods of setting KIs. The motor setting has not been seriously attempted so far, since they can be found without difficulty by hand. Psi settings cannot be found on the Robinson machines, but should be obtainable on Colossus if corruption is not too great. 2. Contrary to our expectations, the Bream wheels did not change on the 10th of January, so that the methods which have been worked out in detail for the machine breaking of wheel patterns, made necessary by the P5 attachment, have not yet been tested. 3. In conjunction with the installation of a direct teleprinter line from Knockholt to this wing of Block F, the general non-operational registries of this section and testers are being amalgamated in a room in this wing. 4. Colossus arrives today. Signed, M.H.A. Newman.
So Colossus comes in. It is really important. This is not to denigrate Colossus at all, because it is a bit of a game changer, just in terms of speed and efficiency. So the Robinson, when it's running reliably, which is not all the time, is running at less than 2,000 characters a second. Colossus 1, which is delivered in January 1944, runs at 5,000 characters a second.
Right.
And with Colossus 2, it's the second machine, but it's also a development of the first design, and that comes in just before D-Day. In June 1944, it runs at 25,000 characters a second.
Gosh.
So it's much faster. Mm. And you can do a run on Colossus in about 10, 20 minutes, which would take hours on Robinson. And this is so important in letting the numeri keep on top of the more frequent German key changes in particular, and keep the output at a decent level right through to the end of the war. It doesn't stop there with Colossus 2 either. They keep producing Colossus machines, so by the end of the war, you've got 10 at Bletchley with another one under construction. But they're also looking for lots of other ways to mechanise the problems they're having. There's a whole suite of smaller machines, which number about 20 in the numeri, and they're designed to perform lots of tasks in key finding, but also in the sort of logistics of what the numeri is doing. They're bringing in all those intercepts every day, either on tape or by teleprinter. And it's about processing all that tape, essentially. So you have machines called things like Angel, Insert, and Junior, which are copying machines.
Okay.
So you can copy tape in various ways. You have a machine called Garbo, which does your differencing. So it prepares your deltaed keystream and keystream to go over to the Colossus for processing. You have a machine called Miles, which checks tapes for accuracy. Just like when you're intercepting the messages, when you're sending them through from Knockholt to Bletchley, there is a risk of corruption occurring. And these have to be as accurate as possible. So what the Miles machine does is take two tapes and add them together. And by the same sort of logic we talked about already, if you combine two identical tapes, you will get a tape which is all null characters.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have a single hole in it. If there are any holes in that tape, you know that one of the tapes is different from the other, and you have to go back and check them and find out where the problem is. You also have a machine called Proteus, which can drag a crib through a message in a basic way. And they actually have another crib dragging machine, which is logically known as Dragon, which does it in a bigger way.
Right.
And what Dragon is designed to do is to set the psi wheels after Colossus has found the chi wheels. And that means you can get your Colossus machines onto the next message. And Dragon uses, as the name suggests, drags a crib through a message until you find the output which indicates a viable psi wheel setting, essentially. So it takes a lot of the pressure off Colossus to do that part of the process, and a lot of pressure off the testery, again, to do that by hand. So you have other key finding machines, but you also have machines to do, as I say, those logistical processes. And accuracy is so important in everything they're processing. A single character that's wrong in a 10,000 character message can cause you to not break that message. So Jack Good, who's working in the numeri at this point, he has a motto which he tries to inculcate to all the staff, which is, if it's not checked, it's wrong. So every message that comes in has to be checked and rechecked. And every time it's copied and reformatted, it has to be checked again to make sure, when it's run through Colossus or one of the other machines, to find the key, that it actually works and you get the right result. It's not about one machine, it's about all the logistical processes going on alongside it as well.
Tom's just told us about all these different other machines we had working on this problem. Now, Colossus didn't have just one job to do, did it? It was found that it could do other jobs later on, wasn't it?
Very much so. And this is one of the really, in hindsight, really important points about Colossus. We've talked about it being sort of a cog in a larger machine in a lot of what we discussed today. But it does stand out in one particular way. And this is, when people look back on Colossus, they talk about its programmability and its similarity to later computers.
Yeah.
I avoid calling it a computer, but it's similar to later computers, because that point really stems from the fact that they find out after they built it that they can apply it to problems that they didn't build it to solve. And that is a really revolutionary thing. If you think of engineering throughout history, really, you have a problem, you build a machine, it solves your problem.
It's to perform a task.
To perform a task. To turn around and then go, oh, actually, we've got a different task over here that machine could also do really well, is a pretty impressive achievement. This comes about partly through necessity, because Tom has described how, with the combination of Colossus and Dragon and things like this, the key finding part of the process, that the wheel setting, the finding out the starting positions of the wheels for the messages, becomes really efficient. The problem you have when Colossus comes into use in January 44 is that the wheel breaking, the working out the pin settings of the wheels, is still being done by hand in the test room.
Yep.
And that process is a bottleneck in the system that, you know, no, it doesn't matter how many Colossi you have. If you can't get the wheel settings in the first place, you can't create a Kai tape to break the message or to find the key for the message. But as we said before, Bill Tutt and the others have not stopped theorizing. They're still coming up with ideas. And confronted with the problem of wheel breaking, of setting the pins on the Kai and Psi wheels, people are still thinking about this. And Bill Tutt, another contribution he makes, you know, it's not all a one-off thing with he's a multi-talented man. He comes at the process called rectangling. And again, it's called rectangle because you basically get a piece of squared paper and you draw a rectangle. You start filling in dots and crosses. But what he works out is that the statistical anomaly that he noticed about dots predominating in certain circumstances is also applicable to wheel breaking. There are methods by which you can use those statistical anomalies to figure out the pin settings of the wheels. And if you can do that, it's really important because it will break that logjam in the testery where this is having to be done by hand. Donald, Nicky and Jack Good, who are working in the Numinary already at this point and are using Colossus every day, look at Tutt's ideas on rectangling and go, actually, Colossus could probably do that. It could apply the statistical method to the wheel setting. And they fiddle about in their spare time. They kind of go in the evenings and plug up Colossus machines and tinker with them. And they find that it is possible to do wheel setting on Colossus, which is not what Colossus was invented for. Colossus was invented to do us, and Heath Robinson were invented to do a different part of the process. And what they're able to do is they go to Flowers and the post office, and Colossus 2, which is delivered in May 1944, has been modified by Harry Fensom, who was at GPO. And he's attached the rather quaintly titled Rectangling Gadget to Colossus 2 and all the subsequent models of Colossus. And so from May 44, they become able to wheel break more quickly, because it's no longer a hand process confined to the testery. It's now a process that you can do on Colossus machines. And this is absolutely vital because, as we said, in July is when the Germans go over to daily wheel setting. So had you been still reliant on hand methods for wheel setting, instead of having to do it every month, you're trying to do it every day, they would have been really swamped. They would have ground to a halt at that point. The fact they've been able to reverse engineer Colossus to solve the wheel braking problem, as well as the Kai setting problem,
yep,
is a massive advantage, even though it's not what the machine is built for in the first place. And this flexibility, the idea that it's somehow a multi-purpose machine, is why people pay so much attention to Colossus as a proto-computer.
Yeah.
Or whatever. It's programmability. And by the end of the war, Colossus is contributing to something like 25 wheel breaks a week. If you imagine that by the end of the war, you've got 50 separate fish links. So you've got 50 new sets of wheels a day. 25 wheel breaks a week is still nowhere near the whole lot, but it's plenty.
It's a good chunk.
It's a good chunk compared to having to do it by hand. And this is where Colossus fits in, that while we've talked about it as the whole of the Tunney story is a story of evolution, both on the German side and on the British side, and there are relatively few moments in which you can say something really revolutionary happened, that if this hadn't happened, they wouldn't have got anywhere. Well, there's kind of loads of those, but no one of them is less important than any of the others, if you like. It's a very evolutionary process. But although Colossus sits at the end of that evolution, and even then, as Tom was saying, it only does a little mechanized part in the middle of a long hand process, it's still really fundamental to that process. All of that extra handwork would not have been any use without Colossus functioning the way it did in the last year and a half of the war.
So what are the stats then? Can we say how important Colossus was?
This is something that I've pondered over for some time, because this whole podcast is about putting Colossus in context and breaking down that myth that somehow you have nothing and then you have Colossus and you have everything. And the fact that the fight against Lorentz is an ongoing process with multiple stages and steps and whatever. The way you can best express that is to look at the overall productivity of the testery and the numinary together, the overall outcomes in terms of reading messages. How many messages are you reading? How often are you reading them?
Yeah.
Etc. And we're really helped with this because the history of the fish section, which is one of the historical documents written at the end of the war in the National Archives has a wonderful couple of pages at the back where they just give you all the numbers.
Oh, brilliant.
And it's brilliant because you can work out exact statistics about all of this information. Basically, you're talking November 1942. We've referred to the fact that that is when operational traffic starts and the Germans start to multiply the number of links they have. Octopus and Codfish are the first two that come into service. By the end of the war, there's something like 55 separate links in operation. So from 42 to 45, you see a proliferation of links, but also more and more traffic being carried on more and more
obviously,
different links.
Yeah.
So obviously more, there's more and more intercept as you go through. The bottom line, the key number, which I've used in any number of talks and lectures over the years, is 63 million characters of Lorenz text is deciphered by the end of the war.
Wow.
Between November 42 and May 45. And 63 million characters, to put it in context, the Bible in English is about 3 million characters. So that you're talking 21 Bibles worth of text, which is quite a lot of words. It's quite a lot of information. Mm. But at the same time, that only represents something like 4% of the intercepted traffic. And all of what Tom was talking about the difficulties of interception, Knockholt and elsewhere, they're only intercepting a tiny fragment of the traffic that's actually being broadcast by the Germans. And of that fragment that they're intercepting, because of the issues with garbling and quality of transmission and everything else, an even tinier subset of that information is then being passed on to Bletchley. And the code-breaking methods that they have available to them, the wheel-breaking methods and everything else, mean that only a minority of those messages are amenable to breaking. Unless the message is more than 4,000 or 5,000 characters long, you can't break it anyway because you don't have enough statistical information. Mm. So at every step from transmission to interception to transfer to Bletchley to breaking to whatever, you're diminishing the proportion of information that actually gets read. So only 4% of what is intercepted is ever read. And actually, the 4% number stays pretty constant through the war. If you look at the statistics, at no point do they break more than 4% of the intercept. But that number goes up because the amount of intercept they're getting is much larger by the end of the war than it is earlier
right,
on.
Right, okay.
So 4% represents many, many more messages. And if you look at that 63 million characters, you can break it down. And prior to Colossus, if you like, from the early handbrakes through to Heath Robinson and the other machines, November 1942 to February 1944, an average of 1.2 million characters is read and sent to customers every month. That's around 18 million characters, which is 29%, just under a third of all the traffic's broken during the war. So in raw terms, a third of Tunney is read without Colossus. So it's not as if there's none and then there's loads. You know, a third of it is already read before Colossus comes along. Colossus 1 is delivered on 18th of January, 1944. It's in operation from March 1944. So you can look at that point onwards from then until May 1945. And during that period, the average monthly output is 2.8 million characters
right.
versus 1.2 million characters before
that's
that.
Quite a lot.
So the productivity has more than doubled on average over that period. So they're producing a lot more decrypt than they were before. But they're still only producing about 4% of what they intercept. They haven't got necessarily more effective at breaking it as a whole. Just there's even more traffic to break, and they're keeping up with it. You know, they're not falling behind in that sense. And that's what gives us 71%. So 29% before Colossus, 71% after Colossus. It shows the contribution of Heath Robinson and the early work and everything else. But it's slightly unfair to Colossus because you have to take into account that 71% also reflects the fact that they've gone over to daily wheel changes. The traffic volume has gone up. There's more links to break. There's 50 links as opposed to 20 links earlier or two links earlier. So what Colossus is mainly doing is allowing Bletchley Park to stay in the game. In the early years, in 42, first half of 43, they're not on top of Lorenz, but they're breaking a useful amount of Lorenz.
Yes.
Had Colossus not come along in 1944, they would inevitably have fallen behind. Robinson simply wasn't reliable enough or fast enough to keep up with the expansion of the traffic. The additional complications the Germans introduced, particularly daily wheel changes, means that without Colossus, they would have fallen hopelessly behind. And although they would have continued to produce decrypts, the decrypts they produced would have been a smaller and smaller proportion of what was out there. with Colossus, they stay at 4%. They keep in the race. And that's its fundamental contribution, really.
July the 10th, 1945. Nothing is left for me to say except good luck and goodbye. And this. The Official Secrets Act will be rigidly enforced as long as there is any possibility of another war. But some of you, who live to be very old, may read one day what the work in BP as a whole, of which yours was a vital part, really meant. Not only to your own country, but to the world. And then you can be proud, and tell your grandchildren the story of the tapes that spun on silver wheels, and how the skill and determination of free men and women, guided by the light of reason freely used, helped to turn the evil tide of fascist irrationalism and slavery in Europe. J.W.J. Herivel.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.